Welcome, movie fans. Thanks for joining us for episode 90 of Reading Between the Reels, the premier podcast of Dutch Angle Appreciation. If you're a new listener, we're so glad you found us. And if you've been enjoying the show, please tell someone about us, post on X or Facebook, write a review on your favorite podcast catcher, or just recommend the show to a friend. I'm Craig Dickinson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Justin Eldon. Corey's out tonight, but should be back next time. How's it going, Justin?
Great.
No joke tonight? So you had plenty of space for that.
Sorry, nope.
It's all good. And tonight on the show, we're thrilled to be joined by David Jesse of Tatooine Sons. Welcome, David.
It's good to be on here, Craig, and I'm not sure I can follow up that amazing intro from Justin. So we'll see if it's all downhill after that. So
it's really the enunciation in the word great, you know, that's what really that's right. brought.
I mean,
the
Tony the Tiger made a career out of it, so we're all good. So.
Yeah, somehow that's a catchphrase. That's amazing.
That's right.
Yes, but tonight we're talking about Mission Impossible from 1996, the first in the Tom Cruise series. And that seems a little random, but we all love this movie, and I really wanted to have David on to talk about it. David, you and your sons did an episode this last summer about Dead Reckoning.
We did.
So engrossed in that and could tell that you had a passion for that film. And so I was like, I want to talk more about that franchise with this guy. So
Love this franchise.
That's the plan. So let's go ahead and start with just our overall thoughts on this film. So, David, I will go ahead and go to you first on that. What are your overall thoughts on this film and the franchise really in general?
Yeah, the franchise is fantastic. I think it's been getting better and better, really. I mean, I think the general consensus I would agree with that starting at three, it picked up it and kind of has been gaining greater and greater momentum throughout. And I'm excited to see where they go with whatever the next movie is. I guess it's not Dead Reckoning Part 2 now. We'll have to see whatever they end up naming it. But I remember sneaking into the theater to watch the original Mission Impossible with my friend, and on opening night, and some amazing stories on that. There was one scene in that which we may talk about later as we talk about sound. I have a feeling where it's a hilarious story of the way people react in movie theaters to different moments, and so. Love the movie. We go back and watch pretty much all the Mission Impossible movies, including the second one, even that one, which is really bad. We go back and watch them at least once a year as a family and have a great time. And it was my birthday this last weekend, and we almost did a marathon where we watched the Ilsa arc. All the movies with her in it, just because that storyline is so much fun. And a great, great, great series. Can't wait to see where they take it.
Awesome. Justin, what about you? What are your thoughts on Mission Impossible?
So love it. This is actually the first movie that I saw on DVD when I was a young lad. My uncle, who in my brain was like the richest man that ever existed, but actually was probably firmly middle class, but he had a DVD player, and I just remember being like, oh, look at the quality. This isn't VHS, this is DVD. So the movie kind of holds like a special place in my heart. Like in my mind, it still feels very like futuristic, even though so much of the technology in there is very dated, but in like a charming way, almost like a relic of the age that it came about. But fantastic film. It has all the great, storytelling elements that a film like this should have, yet somehow coming off the cusp of, if you look at the large picture of other action movies, like, you know, RoboCop, Terminator, Rambo, Escape from New York, if you want to throw that one in there, Lethal Weapon, where you have like these big burly men playing these big action star roles, you get this with Tom Cruise, who's kind of a shorter guy, kind of a smaller guy physically, and he doesn't even ever fire a shot like throughout the entire movie. He never uses a gun, and yet it still works as an action movie. I love it. It's great. It's suspenseful, and it just has all those elements. And then just the music overall, like this movie is inseparable from the music. Like it is up there with the likes of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, like any of the top sounds that are just soundtracks for a movie. this is right up there with them. Like, you could start humming this tune, and I guarantee, like, 90% of people are going to know what you're doing. Yeah, so it's just iconic, and it really shows, I guess, like, how strong of a movie this was, because every Mission Impossible, I mean, you have a lot of different directors with the different Mission Impossibles, but every Mission Impossible after this, in a lot of the way, follows the same formula. They kind of get to it through different ways. Then obviously, like you said, David, 2 is trash, but the rest of them still kind of have that same formula, and it still works even to this day. I mean, Dead Reckoning was a fantastic film that did great at the box office, and it's still just following that same formula, and it works.
Justin, I'm so glad you pulled out the thing about him not firing a gun, because that, I think I'd heard that a long time ago, but that's, I had to think again. Really, is that, yeah, that's actually true. That's kind of amazing.
I've seen a lot on, like, the trivia things about the movie, and then when I went to go watch it, I'm like, does he really not? Like, do I? So I had to pay attention, and I don't think he did. David, you've probably seen it way more than we have. Does he fire a gun?
You know, I'm sitting here, when you said that's the first time I'd ever heard that, and so I'm sitting here processing the entire movie, and there's only really two scenes that I can think of that he would actually have had the opportunity, sort of in that initial mission that they're on, whenever, you know, before everybody's dead, they're dead, they're all dead. That scene, you know, any of that stuff there, he doesn't fire a gun in that. And then, you know, sort of towards the end in the big battle on the train, but at the same time, he doesn't fire anything there. So yeah, I think you're right.
So they pulled it off. I mean, he does in the other films, like, a lot, but this one.
A lot, yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's pretty great. Yeah, I love this film too. I saw this in the theater, and I was just remember that train sequence at the end that we've kind of alluded to, and I'm sure we'll talk about some more, that I was just blown away by that. And, like, I remember explaining to somebody, I was in college at the time, and, like, right before class started, I was, like, getting up on the whiteboard trying to diagram what had actually happened, because it just blew me away. And I, like, even now, I'm still on Justin at lunch. Like, I know that's – yes, big time. I know that's fake, and I've seen it so many times, but even I rewatched it yesterday just to make it sure it was totally fresh in my mind. It was still a gripping scene. It's still just such a well-made film. There's always something interesting happening visually with this film. And I mentioned kind of tongue-in-cheek, like, the Dutch angle thing. There's tons of those, which we'll get to. So many things are happening, the plot twists, and I don't know if you guys were fans at all of either the original show or the 80s, I guess it was a reboot of that kind of a continuation series where Peter Graves came back and played Phelps. But for me, it was a pretty big shock that Phelps turned out to be a bad guy in this. That worked. And that's the thing that initially, I know that was, like, the original cast was upset about that, that they had made Phelps a bad guy. And now that's just kind of gone by the wayside. We don't even think about that because Cruise has become the main character, and that's just a footnote. But I've been watching, every time I watch it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. This was supposed to be a big, big shock to us. That.
Well, and the beautiful thing about it, though, is when they are able to deliver that big twist and that big shock, and you watching it back, it's, you know, it's classic, right? It's the way that it should be done. You watch it back and it pays off the second time through, the third time through. It always seems to make sense that that's what's going on. But the first time you see this movie, you don't sense that that's coming. And the twist really does work. So if you're going to do something as, you know, as shocking as that, you've got to be able to pull it off, and they did a great job at that. So it's pretty cool.
So we're going to go ahead and jump into Justin. You wanted to say something, I thought. No?
Oh no, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let you talk right now because we want to jump into cinematography. So things that you noticed, composition, color, camera work, just anything and everything you noticed visually.
Okay. I do have something to say. I lied. So Craig, you mentioned, train scene.
Yeah.
And we're gonna jump into the train scene a little bit. I don't know, I want to say like a dozen episodes ago, you had mentioned that Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning was your favorite train scene in a movie, or like the best train scene in a movie. I don't remember exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Do you think Dead Reckoning had a better train scene than this one?
Well, there See, they're both train scenes, but it's very different. For me, that...
I don't care. You got to compare them. Nah,
I'm going to go... No, I'm going to go Dead Reckoning. And maybe that's recency bias, but that sequence was so tense for me in the theater watching that. It was every time that thing slid a little bit farther off the cliff, they sustained the tension just so well. Like, at no point did I fear for anybody's life in either part because it's a movie, but that felt more visceral to me with the sound design and everything else, and the fact that it was kind of slower almost, which is kind of amazing that the slower one is the more tense one versus the high speed. Because I think there's a more of a suspension of disbelief when it's slower. It feels more realistic. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna go with Dead Reckoning.
Okay. I'm aware those are very different train scenes. I was just curious because I noticed you mentioned both of them. All right. So cinematography, camera work, things like that. So I feel like this movie does something that we don't get in more modern movies anymore. And it plays with a lot of different camera angles. Almost to the point of through like a modern lens, it's almost kind of distracting, but maybe that's just me because I'm not a fan of Dutch angles. I just feel like you're trying too hard to make us feel like something's off in this scene. Maybe Thor wrecked that for me because I'm pretty sure every shot in Thor is a Dutch angle of some sort. And it's like just Batman 66.
Yeah.
But I mean, they definitely have their place. The scene where, Ethan is in the restaurant, like right before he blows the fish tank.
Yeah, with
Dutch angles there. And it totally works. They're very low Dutch angles as well. And that adds to the tension. Like it, you know, obviously makes you feel on edge. But so the camera angles for me were kind of distracting. I understand why they're there, but I just don't feel like our form of movies really do that as much anymore. Mm-hmm. But something that is a little bit more subtle in this that I didn't immediately pick up on is there are three like very distinct color palettes used in like the three main locations, right? So you have like it was Prague and then Langley and like London. You have like those three major cities. And I read an interview from the director, Brian De Palma, and he mentioned how like he wanted to make those three cities like feel very distinct. Well, I guess with Langley, you don't really see the city. You see more just like CIA headquarters. But he mentioned something to the fact of like how he wanted to make Prague feel like old Europe, and he wanted London to feel like new Europe, and then Langley to feel like America. And if you watch it, like Prague is very dark all throughout, and it's very like mysterious, and there's fog, and there's a lot of like tight shots where you can't really see around corners, which makes sense because it's during the scenes where the team is kind of getting picked off one by one, and it adds to that suspense. Whereas Langley feels like very modern, and it almost like adds to the level of security that they're expected to encounter because it's this very, you know, modern place, and they have obviously very modern, maybe too sophisticated security systems. Like it's kind of ridiculous how sophisticated that is. So it's interesting how different those three locations are. Like I'm pretty sure you could like just clip a single scene from or a single location from any scene in there and probably tell where it is just based on the lighting and the shadows. Like it's that distinct. And you see that a lot in his other films. I haven't seen a lot of his other films, admittedly, but Scarface is the one that I've seen a couple times. And he kind of does that quite a bit. Like he's a huge lighting guy. Like he has, I guess, I feel like a lot of distinct tastes when it comes to lighting, and it really enhances, I feel like, his storytelling.
Nice. David, what about you? What are some visual things that you picked up on?
So when I think back on this, I mean, when you're talking about the Dutch angles and not liking that, I appreciate the way that those are used to build the tension, right? I'm thinking not just in the scene that we talked about in the restaurant with Kittredge, but I'm thinking about primarily the scene in, I guess, whatever the house, the safe house that Ethan goes back to. When he's investigating the compute, you know, he's trying to find all the message boards and all of that. There's the way that they're using that in some of those scenes. And as he's coming to realizations, he does it in the Kittredge scene. He does it in the Job scene when he's finding it in the Bible and stuff like that. Those scenes, those angles cause to build tension in a really effective way. With it, anytime you see Ethan in that film, particularly coming to a realization, they're using those. And so when they're used in such a consistent manner throughout the film, they tend to work better for me than if they're just, you know, a camera angle, for that. So I love that.
Now I feel like I need to rewatch it. Cause you're right. If the Dutch angles are when he's coming to realizations, that, dang it. All right. Changed my opinion. That's cool.
I've seen this movie too many times. And so I'm sitting here processing it, in my head right now. Yeah, I would say that it the whole film is shot in such a way that it feels like it could have been in the 60s in the original series or the 70s. I mean, yes, some of the technology is different, but the idea, the feel of Mission Impossible still fits. And so you're looking back on this film and it fits the Mission Impossible motif so well, probably better, the first movie better than any of the others. They kind of take off, you know, the second one just sort of is like, let's move to a completely different, you know, John Woo does something absurd with that entire movie. And then they move forward with their own storyline after that. But as far as trying to pay homage to the original series and that, it feels more like that as a result of the way that they're doing the cinematography and the angles and those types of things. And I love the editing on it too. I think that the editing was done very well. I love, you know, the connection with Paul Hirsch on that, doing the editing for that. And so, you know, anytime you can bring in the editor from Star Wars and mention him in something, I will. So Paul Hirsch is an amazing editor with that. And his work with Brian De Palma in the past is what led him to that. So it was fun to see them work together on this one as well.
So you guys are taking my good stuff. So I'm gonna dig a little deeper and see what else I can pull out. The restaurant scenes, that's really probably the quintessential great scene from this film. But a couple other things that I want to pull out is there's a lot of just wide shots where it wouldn't necessarily be wide shots. They'd be close shots. A couple of different times that I noticed that, first off, when there's you see the whole team sitting in a safe house and there's kind of this circular briefing, the seating arrangement, which I thought was interesting because it's kind of like there, and then this camera slowly pans around instead of kind of going one shot of this guy, one shot of this guy, alternating back and forth. And you know what I'm thinking from that is that there's definitely kind of this equality and this camaraderie between this team. They're very closely knit. And so, and that builds in that this is a team that's worked together for a while, and then, you know, they die 20 minutes later. It's pretty shocking. We get to know these characters, and then the film takes a left turn that way. There's another one where Claire comes in after he's been sitting at there, and she kind of wakes him up, and it stays wide, and you get to see this, the actors unfold, the action unfold that way, which is, I thought, kind of different. Great mix of stuff, though. Like, everything's obviously very intentional. I think of also there's some great close-ups, extreme close-ups, like in the vault. Really, just the vault is another section where you're using bird's eye view and just extreme low angles, and you have this close-up of the sweat drop. Just pull in the tension there because it is it's so slow, and it just becomes this huge thing, and it just it's just beautifully done. Anything else on cinematography before we move on to sound?
I feel like I kind of ragged on the weird angles there a little bit, which I'm going to rewatch it with the Dutch angles. I'm going to appreciate them. But another thing I wanted to mention is there are a couple scenes where the camera is almost like spinning. It's not quite spinning, but it's kind of like,
yes,
I guess, like swirling in.
He's going up the staircase.
Yeah.
As going up the staircase. And then there's another one where it's like early in the morning and he's sitting there trying to like figure out what's going on in his safe house. And it's almost like, I don't know. The camera does a really good job with what David said in mind about the Dutch angles of portraying Ethan's emotions through that camera angle. And I don't feel like it does that to any other character. So, and I guess you just don't, I need to have an appreciation for it, but you don't see that in movies as much anymore. I feel like they're not as crazy with those camera angles. So it was a bit jarring, but I need to respect it.
Yeah, there's like a different setup. There's multiple different setups in every scene. It's very much, we don't ever let the camera just sit there. Mm-hmm. Or very rarely do we. Except for those just kind of strangely set, yeah, this is a wide shot. I'm going to just let this play out and you get to see everything. So.
Kind of on that same topic, like the difference between movies in the 90s and movies today. I watched the Siskel and Ebert review of this movie, and they mentioned that they liked the movie overall, but they just said that the plot was too confusing. And I think it was Ebert said, I don't think anyone could leave the theater and actually tell me what the plot was about, but it was a great movie nonetheless. And that kind of like, do we expect more from movies today? Because I do not feel like that movie was confusing. Like, it was pretty straightforward. It was like a spy thriller. When this first came out, you guys are a little older than me. When it first came out, did people feel that way? Was it like, this is confusing? I'm not going to watch this.
I think there was a bit of that. I think that number two is an overreaction to that, because it really simplifies things dramatically from this. Oh. I remember hearing those complaints, and then scene two is like, no, we'll just dumb it down for you. Now it's just, hey, there's a bad guy. We got to get that thing away from him.
They went too far the other way. They turned it into a James Bond movie. Nothing against James Bond. I love those movies.
Yeah, a bad James Bond movie. No, I don't recall it being, I don't remember being confused by it. And I don't recall, but I also don't know if I was sort of, I wasn't into movies in the same way that I've grown to be into them over the last decade plus. So I don't recall like hearing people talk about it. I just remember thinking, it was so shocking, right? Like, so I think that's one of the things that's beautiful. I know we'll talk about that, the story a little bit more later, but, and you know, when we look at the cinematography, and you guys were talking about the wide shots with the team and them being, you know, all of them being killed, I think that made the reaction of the general audience may have been as much about the fact that, Phelps is the villain and everybody gets killed off in the first, mission, and except for Ethan and Claire, but all of that creates confusion when people are expecting what they got with the Mission Impossible series, and the mm-hmm. team's going to get through it and all of that. So the plot gets confusing with that. I'll use this as an example. The first time I saw, the reason I bring this up is I rewatched it this weekend with my youngest son. The first time I watched Logan, I hated it. And I hated it because I had this expectation over Professor Xavier, and if he's going to go out, he's going to go out in like this big dramatic like moment with it, and he gets killed in his bed by an imposter, and it pissed me off. And because I got so frustrated with everything, I just stopped paying attention to the rest of the movie, and I hated the movie as a result of it. And so rewatching it again this last weekend, the appreciation was there because I was able to deal with my confusion in a different way. And so I think that maybe that was a lot of what people were running into. I could see Ebert being frustrated with the movie because of what he had experienced with his expectations coming into it. And as a Star Wars fan, I know how expectations can destroy the way you view a movie. So
that's so. Very true.
Our last couple episodes, we've thrown some shade at Star Wars.
I love Star Wars, but I understand the situation.
Yeah.
Star Wars movie is The Last Jedi. So, yeah. So I definitely understand the frustration that people go through.
Okay, this is not what this podcast is about, but we need to dissect that later. Okay.
Yeah.
Craig's like, uh-oh.
No, we had a great episode on episode 8. And then we throw a lot of shade at episode 9. We do, but yeah. Anyway,
I like 8. I like 8 for the record, but I know that's not a good. That's not a very popular opinion.
Well, it's a controversial. All right, sorry. There's people on both sides. Okay, that's fine. So, sound effects, soundtrack, vocal sounds. Justin, I'm gonna go back to you again.
I'm going to veto that because you always make us go first and then you just blow us out of the water. Just do your thing, Craig, so you don't show us up later.
Okay. I'm not going to say a ton. I just wanted to say that the sound of Emilio Estevez getting, you know, just impaled in the face. That squelch sound is, that sticks with me. It's so bad. And really,
my wife
just
won't watch this movie because of that sound.
It's bad. It's great.
She heard it once when she was like 18 and she's like, never again.
Just want him to duck and just get down, dude. He doesn't. He just takes it right in the face. The lack of sound in the vault, I think, though, is the most impressive thing. Sound design wise. It's amazing. I'm appreciating that more and more when I see films that take the sound out. I mean, go back to Last Jedi just for a second. Like, if you do that right, it's very impressive. We talked about this with Oppenheimer too. When the bomb went off the first time, you have to wait for the explosion, the sound of the explosion. I'm just gonna throw out just a couple more, Justin. I won't take them all. I bought the soundtrack.
No, please take them all.
I bought the soundtrack when this movie came out, and it's one of those things that just cracks me up when a soundtrack for a film has all of these pop songs on it, none of which are heard in the film. They always go like from or inspired by or some nonsense. But the Cranberries Dreams is played at the end, which is great. And I'm a huge U2 guy. So this was the one. I think it was kind of like, well, Bono and the Edge did, you know, they did Goldeneye. And so we'll do the other spy one. And so, yeah, Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen Jr. do a cover of the Mission Impossible theme, Lalo Schifrin's theme. They played it over the end. So that's technically in the movie because it plays over the end credits. And I will stop for now. So what else?
Danny Elfman.
Thank you. Yeah.
What else? Were you saving that one for me, Craig?
I was hoping you would say Danny Elfman. Love Danny.
Thank you. Danny Elfman is like the soundtrack of my childhood, like between The Simpsons and Batman, pretty much. But I mean, he doesn't disappoint in this. I can't think of a time when he does. But the film itself, I feel like the soundtrack, at least the soundtrack used within the film and not the inspired by CD that Craig bought. It uses a lot of like rhythmic percussion all throughout to kind of constantly build that tension. And then just like in the vault scene, like we already mentioned this, but it very notably stops. It is one of the more stressful moments in movie history. I would put it top 10 because of the lack of sound that it creates. And I feel like that is a very hard thing to pull off. I remember, I couldn't tell you which James Bond movie it is, but it's one of them with Sean Connery where during several of the fight scenes, they cut the music. And it is just done terribly, in my opinion. It does not build suspense. It just feels empty. It feels like somebody, like they didn't have the budget for it or something. So there, in my opinion, there are good times to cut the sound and bad times to cut the sound. And this movie is one of the earlier ones that I can remember where it was, it's a fantastic moment to just hit the wall of silence.
I keep coming back to, it really is one of my favorite scenes in all of the franchise is the scene where Ethan is by himself in the safe house and he's researching. I think that the track, the way that they do the track on that, and just even something as simple as I think they crank up the sound of the keys on the computer or the keyboard and things like that. And so you're just feeling the tension as he's researching this, trying to figure it out, going to message board after message board after message board and trying to get a bite and that kind of thing. And then when you hear, you know, he's broken that light bulb and put it outside the hallway so that he can hear if somebody's coming in, and he's having this nightmare where he's seeing all these things happen. And then you start hearing that cracking and all of that as Claire is actually coming in on that. I thought that was beautifully done. I think that as the father of a son whose goal in life is to become a re-recording mixer in the film industry, we talk about sound a lot in our family, and what we always seem to come back to that sound is done best when they're willing to not overdo it. And so when you think about the room in Langley, with that, there's the silence element, but then you also hear like the pinging, the clicking in the sound meter, and you hear the feet of the rat in the in the duct, and you hear the core, the cable, as the hook or whatever the thing has been messed up, and it's rubbing, and they're using sound that way. So it's not just the silence. It's when you hear things in that scene that makes the tension of that scene. You know that you can't be hearing any sounds, and so you're hearing just the tiny. So it's the same thing that they're doing in the A Quiet Place franchise in the first two movies. Mm-hmm. With that, is every time sound is there, it increases the tension even more and more. So here's a funny story with this, right? So I mentioned at the opening of the show, I see this movie on opening night. We sneak in, my friend Brock and I, we go to the movie theater. There's this massive line, and they're waiting to get in. They're standing by the turnstiles, and we say that we need to go use the restroom, which is on the other side of the turnstiles at this movie theater. So we sneak into the movie theater and then wait in the bathroom until the crowd starts going in from that. And we just fold ourselves into the crowd and drift into the movie theater with it. And so then we get prime seats. You know, when this is what was this 96?
96.
That this came out. So we're sitting there in 96, and there's no assigned seats or anything. So you just fold into the crowd and you sit down. We're sitting in the very middle. So we get to this scene in Langley where sound is, you know, the as big of a character in the scene as anything else. The silence has to be. And my friend Brock leans over to me and he whispers in my ear. He's like, "Watch this. This is going to be hilarious." And I'm like, "Oh my God, what is Brock getting ready to do?" And so all of a sudden it's just dead quiet. And he screams to the top of his lungs. He's like, "My God, this is intense," as loud as he can. And this entire theater, packed from to the gills, jumps out of its seats. Popcorn goes flying. People are cursing. They get so jumped. And then this just like the next second, silence comes over it. And then they start laughing because they realize how invested they were in that moment that it was able to pull them out like that. And I think that that's a testament to how powerful that scene is and how they used silence so effectively, because everybody reacted to that in such an impactful way and then found it funny as a result. So,
as a middle school teacher who just loathes the moment when the one kid decides to be the class clown and like break the silence, that story appalls me. Like, I am disgusted by that story. For any middle schoolers that are listening right now, don't stop it. Get some help.
That's beautiful. Oh,
I wish I could say I was in middle school when we did that. So,
I mean, that being said, I'm sure we've all done that before in different ways.
That sounds like a fun moment, though.
Yeah.
A couple other things I want to talk about. No segue here at all. Back to sound real quick. there's a couple of great voiceovers that I really like. And not every film that we do has even uses voiceover, but there's two that I really like. Hunt's voiceover explaining the heist for the knock list as he's explaining it to the guys as they're on the train. And they're just showing that whole thing as it's happening. Love that as an editing bridge. But what's really interesting, and I think this gets to kind of the confusing thing, is he's having that conversation with Jim. And they're talking about Kittredge, but they're showing Jim doing all of the things, which I thought, like, there's two very different things happening, one visually, one audio. I think the first time I saw that, I was really confused. But every time I watch it now, I'm like, yeah, he's already figured it out. Just kind of a really interesting thing. There's this dichotomy there that doesn't quite match up. So I like it.
I think that's probably what some of the confusion that was being talked about when we were talking about the reception to the film. That scene probably plays into that. I think it's, and it does, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, how the payoff of the Phelps storyline in this works, because the first time you're confused and you're starting to put it together as Ethan is putting it together during that voiceover moment. And then the second time you watch it, you're like, oh my gosh, he's got this figured out and it all works. And so it's a really cool scene.
So, with this movie being like so much of a focus on Ethan and Tom Cruise, could any other actor have pulled that off? Like, would this movie be the same? Would it have been the same success if it was, I don't know. Throw out an actor. Tom Hanks. Just kidding. Not him. sorry, it's the first thing that came to mind.
This is Cruise's baby. He's a producer on this. So this is
his first film that he produced, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
This is very much in his wheelhouse, made for him. This is a vehicle in all the mm-hmm. senses of the word. So, I'm trying to think of who's a big action star in the late 90s. I mean, Stallone and Schwarzenegger are on the tail end of their careers.
Yeah, Gibson is all those guys during that time.
It's kind of past that.
They all had their big franchises. I'm not sure that they would have been able to have carried a film like this, because there's a level of sophistication with this that you're not going to get with those people. You've got to see Ethan being able to carry himself in so many different settings in this one to make it work. And you're not going to see that with Sly. You're not going to see that with Schwarzenegger or Gibson. And I don't know of another actor that could, that seems from that era, that would have been able to pull that off.
Yeah. Well, and the character of Ethan just plays so strongly to Tom Cruise's strengths. I mean, he's more or less the same character that he is in Top Gun, right? And he's the seasoned hotshot who like breaks rules sometimes because he knows better than the establishment type thing. You know, like that's kind of what he is in all of his movies. I'm not complaining. Mm-hmm. He does it well, but
yeah.
Except for Tropic Thunder, that's very different Tom Cruise.
Yes. This is a beautiful segue into performance, Justin. Yeah, I was thinking of the scene where he's being essentially interrogated by Max, you know, takes the hood off, and then she tells him no, and he just laughs, big grin on his face. Like, he's completely at ease, even when everyone else would just be like, oh, I'm in trouble. This is not going the way I want it to. Just exuding charm and confidence. Yeah, great performances all around. I don't think there's anybody that stands out as being off or just greater. I think they're just all, it's very well cast, an international cast for this film.
Mix things up a little bit, because I feel like we're just saying good things. No, I said bad things about Dutch Angles. I don't like Luther. I don't like him. I haven't liked him in any of the movies.
In the franchise? In the whole franchise?
The whole franchise. From what I understand, they intentionally cast Luther because they wanted someone who was very different from the stereotypical hacker.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it. You, that was your goal. You hit it, but I don't like him.
Well, and I think to this point, like, his biggest role had been in Pulp Fiction. At least that's the thing that I remembered him from when I saw this. And so very different character than what he played in that film. So it kind of very much casting him against type, but I liked it. I always thought it was.
Now, I've tried to remember all the films that Luther Stickles' character is in. He's obviously not. I don't think he's in two at all, is he?
No, I think he is. You know, he's in two. Pretty sure.
I don't remember him in two. I think in three, doesn't he just make like a quick cameo at the end,
too? At the very end, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Justin,
while we're he is in two.
Yeah, I recently watched it. Not that I enjoyed it, but yeah, I did recently watch it.
You're right.
Is there one that he's not in?
He's basically not in three. He cares, like Justin was saying, is it the very end? He shows up at the end to kind of talk about keeping an eye on the Ethan's wife. I can't remember
her name. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's keep in mind. Okay. Well, this is usually the part where we start pulling out our favorite lines of dialogue. So, David, I'll start with you.
That's easy. I quote it all the time. It's the scene when, he's talking to Claire after she comes back to the safe house and he's explaining everything. And for some reason, that line where he yells, and I even quoted it earlier, like, they're dead. He's dead. He's talking about Jim. He's like, he's dead. They're dead. They're all dead. I use that phrase all the time with my family. I don't know. Anybody's like a movie where they die, I shout it out. I think it's a horribly delivered. It's one of the worst delivered lines in the entire movie. But it sticks with me. So I have fun with that.
Justin, do you have a line of dialogue that you would like to share?
I had that one because it's awkward.
It is, you know, it follows that melodramatic category for sure. It's like
yeah. I don't I know this doesn't count as a line of dialogue, but it's a communication nonetheless by a character. But that scene where the guy at Langley walks back into his office and the second the knife hits the table and just like, and I know this isn't dialogue. I'm going to break your rule, Craig.
It's under performance.
But just the expression on his face of like utter confusion, like how in the world did this knife get here? Like I don't know. I feel so bad for that guy all throughout this movie. Like he's just trying to do his job.
Yeah.
And he just has to poop all the time. He's all constantly in and out. Like it can't be easy getting in and out of that place to go to the bathroom. I mean, that poor guy.
It's funny when you think about it, you know, this will skip us back a little bit to some of the cinematography and the dialogue and everything that we've already talked about, because that scene's such a central thing. But does anybody get the same vibes watching that scene as they do in like the heist scenes in like the Oceans franchise, like where the voiceover, we're going to explain how we're doing the heist, and then you're seeing those moments happen and they're sabotaging this one person to get in, and it's the same storyline happening. It's just in a different franchise. Every time I see those, I think of the parallels.
See, I always kind of assumed Ocean's 11 took that from this movie.
Right.
Maybe it didn't. Yeah. Maybe it was just a happy coincidence, but they're pretty dang similar in the way they do those heist scenes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, because you ripped on Ving Rhames, I'm going to use a Luther Stickle quote.
Nice.
Dang it, Craig.
They talk about Hack NORAD? Whatever it was, and he says, there was never any physical evidence I had anything to do with that. That exceptional piece of work. Luckily, kind of humble brags.
It's a hard line to get out, the way he communicates. I mean, that's try to say that one three times fast, and you'll have
because Ving Rhames can act, man.
That's it. I thought you were going to say, we've got the meats.
That's also him. Exactly.
Because that's, yeah.
He's an Arby's pitchman. Come on.
Is that him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh man, and I've defended Arby's for so many years. Everyone makes fun of Arby's, and I'm like, oh, I love Arby's. I don't know what the big deal is. That's it.
Gotta go all the way now. Rames. Oh my gosh.
I don't hate Ving Rhames. I just don't like the character.
Probably doesn't like Lilo and Stitch either. So
that's true. That's him there too. Yeah.
Totally fine. Well, Lilo and Stitch was. You know what? This isn't about Lilo and Stitch. We don't need to get off into that. But no, just didn't like Luther. He's just a little too. He feels manufactured to me.
Like I don't think this franchise works without Luther, though.
I like him.
I like the character of Luther. I just don't like who's playing. I'm just putting someone else in there and have him say the lines.
Okay. David, you want to throw out another line?
I don't know. Nothing is popping into my head tonight as far as a specific line. I can't remember the line, but I remember the scene, and I love the dialogue in it. Between when is it Jack? Is that Emilio Estevez's character?
Mm-hmm.
Jack is in the elevator shaft, and everybody's on their comms. They're in those different things, and the banter that's going on. I don't remember the specific lines, but the banter that goes on between the team as they're actually executing the mission, the fun that they poke at each other, the jokes, the side little comments, and things like that. I think that's. It's really effectively done in helping you see that not only is this a team that knows how to execute their mission really well, but they actually are friends and they like each other, which really brings weight to when everything falls apart. Which, again, as going back to sitting in that theater for free, watching that very first time, I'm really transported back to how shocking that moment is when the team is destroyed. And I think that the dialogue and the friendship, but going all the way back to the very first, the opening when, Claire is, it appears she's dead. And then Ethan rips the mask off at the opening scene and all of that kind of thing. And then they're sitting there debriefing and talking about this mission. I think the relationships that we see in that, the characterizations there really help to add weight to how devastating that moment is when the team is completely destroyed.
Yeah. It's amazing how quickly they can build that connection with the audience just through the quirky lines and the banter. Mm-hmm. They do that incredibly well.
I'm going to use some more banter, Justin, because I'm just going to keep sticking up for my man, Luther Stickle. At the end, At the end, Ethan says, "So how does it feel to be a solid citizen again?" And he says, "Man, I don't know. I'm going to miss being disreputable." And Ethan says, "Well, Luther, if it makes you feel any better, I'll always think of you that way." I love that so much. I want to just, we'll skip down a little bit too. We talked about body language, facial expressions a little bit already, but when I found in my research, De Palma actually designed most of the action sequences, which is pretty great. And Cruise did a lot of his own stunts, which he's want to do. Anything else you guys want to talk about with, well, we talked about the masks already, costumes, hair, makeup, facial expressions, body language, any just one-off stuff before we move on?
I think that the weakest point in this movie is the masks that Tom Hanks wears. Like when he's playing that senator at the party, it's like, oh, so this is old Tom Cruise. He really is done poorly.
And the voice too.
When they first show that senator, like I think they show him on TV for the first time.
Right. So you're like, oh, so that's who Tom Cruise is going to be pretending to be in the next scene.
Immediately, right? You're just like, ah, Tom Cruise.
That's
true. I mean, that being said, though, it's like my least favorite thing about the Mission Impossible franchise are the masks. I think they're, as a plot point, they're far too convenient, and they only get more and more convenient as the movies go on.
What are you talking about? They get more inconvenient because they backfire over and over and over again throughout the rest of the franchise. Well, they have
to nerf them because they're too powerful and they're too convenient. Like in Dead Reckoning, they use the mask to portray the White Widow, right?
Yeah.
But they don't even bother to like change her eye color, and she's a very different sized person. Like there are so many things wrong with it. I think in Mission Impossible 3, when they do it to who's the guy?
Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, Hoffman. That is probably the best use of it because it shows like how difficult it is to use the mask because they have to, you know, get him to say the phrase and they have to get him alone and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like I love it in that movie, but the rest of the movies, I'm just like, this is too easy. I don't like it. Mm-mm. If you can just mask up anybody at any point, like it's not, I don't know. I'm not a fan of the masks.
That's my biggest thing with the second one. They're just way overused.
Yeah. It's at some point, I swear in that movie, they were going to like take a mask off and then take a mask off underneath that mask. I'm like, they're going to do it. They're going to do it at some point. They never did though. Not that I remember. I've only seen that movie once. It was really bad.
It's not good. I'm going to just shoot down to the setting, the design. Shot in Prague, actually. That's pretty cool. A lot of it in Pinewood. I did have a note that I said it's the best ventilation duct scene since Die Hard. Mm. That's probably the one I always think of when I think of ventilation duct. But it's so well done. Like the rat crawling up there. And you mentioned the sound, David, just so good.
Why all these ventilation ducts keep being made man-sized. Just make smaller ventilation
right
ducts
over
all your secure
security problems. Places on the planet, right?
That's true. Let's see. Set decoration and props. Justin, you talked a little bit about the charming outdated computers, which I think that's the one thing with this film that dates it. Other than that, like it holds up really, really well.
It does.
But it's almost like it's a parallel universe with the computers and stuff sometimes.
I love it though. Like for those of you that know me in real life, I'm a huge like tech nerd. And to just see like when Ethan opens that laptop for the first time and it's like slowly zooming in on him, you can tell that it's almost portrayed as like, oh, look at this high tech piece of machinery. We got like 4 megabytes of memory or something . It's charming and quaint. Yeah. Oh, simpler times.
It's got a floppy disk in it.
Oh yeah, I do miss floppy disks. They just had a nice tactile feel to it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I like the tech in here.
Well, one thing I thought was interesting with this was I don't think I'd ever quite made the connection between, he's doing the magic trick with that, with the discs that, of course, he does a similar magic trick in the most recent movie. And I was like, they've actually kind of seeded that all the way through, that's the sleight of hand thing is a thing that he does. That's a character beat. So,
It turns out that was like, sorry, I looked at the movie trivia. This was not me. That was actual sleight of hand. That was not a camera trick. Tom Cruise did that. For realsies.
Nice. Close-up magic. Mm-hmm. The knife, I think Krieger's knife is a pretty important thing. We see that really early on. They have a close-up of that when he sees his teammate killed on the fence, and then we see it later when he stops the guy from killing the security guard at Langley. So.
No, I think the most important prop in the entire film is the Bible from the Drake Hotel. Right. If you, you know, if he doesn't find the Bible on the bookshelf in the safe house from the Drake Hotel, then he doesn't figure out Job 3:14. And then he doesn't figure out that Jim is the actual villain that's been, that is behind all of this, with it. So, it's a huge piece of this that I absolutely love how they bring that in. And you start seeing, like, again, it's the realization as Ethan is figuring it out in the safe room and he's trying to understand what Job 3:14 is. And then he sees that Bible and it clicks, for him. I think that's beautiful. And then he uses, you know, Job 3:15 for the next message and all of that kind of stuff. It's fun. It's really, really fun. Yeah. And as far as the set pieces go or the locations, I love the way that they utilize the aquarium mm-hmm. in the restaurant as the escape mechanism. You know, he uses the red light, green light that he gets from Jack that he's been holding onto the gun. That's a set piece that's huge that comes back in multiple times throughout the movie, and he throws that to the thing and it blows up. That's such an iconic moment in the film. It was an iconic moment in the trailer that that you kind of are anticipating. For those of us that were going to the movie theater to see this originally, that was a fun moment from it. So it's a really fun, cool element.
It's kind of funny looking back, though. I'm not ragging on this movie. I love this movie. I feel like someone in this podcast always has to like take the devil's advocate side, and Corey's not here, so I'm going to do it this time. Tom Cruise, you know, famous for doing his own stunts, but that stunt with the fish tank, comparatively, is such low stakes to the stunts he does now, like on the buildings or on the planes or on the motorcycle. Like,
right.
I'm going to jump out of a room with a bunch of water and glass. Like, man, you've come a long way, Tom.
Yeah.
That being said, it was a cool scene. I love the scene.
Yeah. And, you know, David, you mentioned that it was in the trailer. A lot of this movie was in the trailer, like some of the action sequences. And even in the most recent one with the, you know, driving, when we saw how it was made, you know, driving the motorcycle off the cliff. And yet when you see it in the context of the film, it still works. And that, I think, speaks to how well designed some of these sequences are, that you know what's going to happen and you're still sucked into the film.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the story is done so well. Like, you can see the visuals, and the visuals will pull you in a trailer, but the story is what's going to keep you with it. We've all been to movies where the trailer looks like it's absolutely amazing and all the visuals are there. And then you walk in and you're 30, 45 minutes into it and all the best scenes. I think this happens more in comedy movies than anything, right? The best gags happen in the trailer, and then you get in, you're like, I've already seen all this, right? That's not the case on this movie at all. The visuals add to the moment. That aquarium scene feels so much bigger when you see it in the movie than it is in the trailer because of the tension that's going on between Kittredge and him. So those types of things are, I mean, even in the trailer, you saw him fall, suspended in the computer room. You see that in the trailer. That's one of the big moments of the trailer. You know that's coming in the movie, but when it happens in the movie, the story is so intense to that point that it's the payoff of seeing that scene is even better than you could have dreamed.
Well, and it hits like culturally too. Like, think of how many times that scene has been redone or parodied. Like, that's a pretty famous movie scene right there.
As they say about imitation, it's the sincerest form of flattery. So
that's it.
So moving on to characters, is there anybody that we haven't talked about that we need to, either actor or characters? We talked about most of them, but there's a huge cast. One thing I want to point out, just Vanessa Redgrave as Max, mm-hmm. and the fact that they didn't bring her back per se, but they brought the legacy of that character back in the later films, I thought was kind of a cool twist. But a lot of things are harkening back to that first film with the White Widow and her daughter.
You're going to have to explain that to me. Who do they bring back?
The White Widow is her daughter.
Oh my goodness.
Suddenly Dead Reckoning is such a better film.
Wait, where do we learn that? What movie do we learn that in?
That actually in the previous movie that she was in, which is what? Is it the fifth movie?
Fallout?
Yeah, I think Fallout, it's Fallout. Right? Yeah, I think it's Fallout.
This is a franchise where I do not remember the names of
any of the movies. There's a lot going on in all of they demand a rewatch. I mean, I think they worked just fine on the first one.
This franchise does get better the more times you watch it, especially when you get to 5 and 6, because 5 and 6 tie in so many elements from previous stories and characters with it, especially, let's see, I forget the names of the movies, confused. Fallout 5?
Fallout's 5, yeah.
Yeah. That's the one where it seems like they literally are tying in every previous film. It was the end of the franchise is what it felt like watching that,
yeah,
in the theater with that. And so that's why when they bring in the White Widow and you tie in Max, it's so impactful in that with it. So
I realize, yeah. I just misspoke. Five is Rogue Nation. 6 is Fallout.
That's it.
That's 4 it. Is Ghost Protocol. I was like,
yeah. Whichever one is the one that ties it all together.
I need to watch these movies again. I know. Yeah. So I know, yeah, 6 is the one with Henry Cavill. So I'll go that.
That's the one I'm thinking of. So, that's the fantastic one.
Yeah. That's Fallout. Yeah. It's the helicopter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. After watching the first one for our show, I'm like, I need to go back and watch all of them again, like in order, because I've seen them all multiple times, but I don't think ever consecutively. And
yeah, I don't think I have either.
I guess I didn't realize how interconnected these movies are. Like they work pretty well as standalone films, but also they do a good job of making sure that they're not leaving too many plot holes. But man, I missed that White Widow, daughter of Max thing. That's embarrassing. Feel free to edit that out, Craig.
What's fun about this franchise, right? You talk about how they're standalone films, but then for those of us that are like big, big fans of the franchise, and you've watched, you know, like I said, I watch this with my family and I, we watch this, rewatch it once a year, probably with, you know, over a period of time. When you are a fan like that and you get to see the interconnectivity between the stories, the one that they leave out the most is 2, gladly, yeah, with that. But, when you see that interconnectivity, it's a great payoff for all of us, but it doesn't rely on that so much that people that aren't as obsessed with it as I am, are at a disadvantage when they watch it. And I love that.
Yeah. I think you could pretty much start at any film and not feel lost. I mean, there's backstories, but they're not dependent upon it. Right. If you didn't know Max, if you hadn't even seen the first movie, you'd still appreciate Kittredge for who he is. But seeing the first movie and that movie, you're like, oh, this is how that character, that relationship with Ethan Hunt has evolved.
And it kind of, this is the type of movie that you can kind of like in my mind, there are 2 types of movies. There's a movie that you have to watch, like Tenet. Okay. You have to watch that movie. If you're doing anything else, if someone sneezes during that movie, you're lost. And then there's other movies where, you know, you can kind of be on your phone. You can kind of be doing other things while the movie's happening. I feel like this movie could easily go both ways. Mm-hmm. You could be distracted and still very much enjoy it, or you can watch it not with a fine tooth comb. You could, whatever, you know, you could watch it closely and still get a lot out of it. Like it works both ways for sure.
All right. Anything else on characters, or are we ready to move?
I always feel bad for the other 2 characters outside of, you know, Jack always stands out in my mind because it's Emilio Estevez, and you kind of expect him to have had a bigger role in that. But then there's the 2, I can't even remember their names. The 2 other women in the team that die in the beginning, the one that's in the car.
Kristen Scott Thomas plays Sarah, and she's a fairly big actress and had a pretty.
She was a big actress at the time, for sure. Yeah.
Right. And then the other one that gets killed. Hannah, but I won't even try to pronounce her name.
There we go.
Ingeborga. Yeah.
Their characters end so quickly that, you know, there's no really way to comment on them. They were just sort of there to be killed with that. That may be just the reality of what they had to do with it, but it was I always feel bad for those 2 as far as characters go.
So I always wondered, do you think that sometimes they intentionally cast big names in roles like that to kind of subvert expectations, so you're not expecting them to be killed off?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it does. I think that the fact that Kristen Thomas and Emilio Estevez were in that team, and John Voight, it And it's interesting if you think about it, because those two, all three of them dying in that moment plays to your acceptance of the reality that Phelps is dead. With it. And so you've got those bigger name actors that died. And so you're just like, well, I guess that means that all three of them are dead. If John Voight is dead and all these other are no-name characters that you or no-name actors that you've never really paid any attention to and had never heard of before, you start to, I think that we would, as an audience, start to suspect maybe there's something more going on with John Voight. But because you bring in a Kristen Thomas, a Scott Thomas, and you bring in an Emilio Estevez, and those characters are dead, it helps you buy the reality that that Phelps is dead in that.
That makes sense?
That makes sense, yeah.
So, hero's journey, I don't really have, it's not really a traditional hero's journey, but I just had just the fact that we have, and kind of transitioning from that, as you have Phelps dying, supposedly, or at least in the film, he does die, but you have this kind of ascension of Ethan Hunt as the clear protagonist of the film and the series, which I think they overdid in the second movie. I think that was one of the things that bugged me a lot. Okay, now it's just a James Bond ripoff and Ethan, it's you know, American James Bond. But I think more than anything that watching this film again, in the context of the other films, is that Cruise has really aged nicely into the mentor role and the team leader in the series, where I didn't necessarily anticipate that when I first saw this movie, like, oh, you're just going to make it's a Tom Cruise vehicle. But now it's like, it makes sense that he's, you know, he's the mentor, but also can still handle all these things, the physical things as well.
Yeah. And I think that the third movie does a really good job of being the bridge for that, right? Because he's literally the mentor, the teacher, in that one. And he's so committed to saving Keri Russell's character, when she's, in jeopardy there and all of that, that you buy that moment. And then it becomes where he, you know, he does become the, you know, the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the rest of the franchise. He always seems to be bringing like, for whatever reason, I can't remember his name. He's he plays in the second. He's in that I think in that movie Beyond. He plays the tech guy that ends up becoming a field agent. I can't remember his name right now. Why is it bugging? You know who Simon I'm talking Pegg? About, right? Yeah,
Simon, Benji. Yeah.
Benji. Yeah. So Simon Pegg's character. Yeah, I mean he literally takes him and mentors him up to becoming an actual. A field agent throughout the franchise with that. And then it's, you know, here's some fun with this, but I had a big, so when the Dead Reckoning films were in the theater, that opening night premieres and all that kind of stuff, I threw out a tweet that ended up getting some traction with Christopher McQuarrie. And we ended up having a direct message thing that went on for about a week about some Easter eggs. And he still won't tell me what, it was fun. It was fun at the time. He's, you know, he was trying to give me, point me in directions to some Easter eggs, but we ended up having a conversation about, I think that Haley Atwell's character is Ethan's daughter. And if you go back and you watch Dead Reckoning again, as if he's the father and she's the daughter, that movie hits very differently all the way through, and he wouldn't confirm it, but he also wouldn't deny it with it. So it was kind of fun, and he was denying a lot of things that we were doing.
Have we talked about that, Justin?
I thought there were, what's that?
I said I was asking if we had talked about that possibility.
I don't think we talked about that. I assumed they were introducing her as like a new love interest.
Mm-mm. She's his daughter.
But it was weird to me thinking that there were. That was a new love interest because she's so much younger than him.
Yeah.
But daughter.
Yeah. And with the flashbacks and all of those things, like, yeah.
Well, even the way he teaches her to drive.
Yeah.
That's what I immediately thought of. Such the relationship is very father-daughter in the way that they do things in that. So it's fun to watch, but that goes back to this, how they've aged him, right? Because he's the protege. In the first movie, and by the end of the first movie, he's now the leader of the team. He's the one receiving, you know, at the beginning of the
That's
movie,
how it
John
ends.
Voight's, yep. yeah, Phelps is getting the notification about the mission on the airplane. At the end of the movie, it's Hunt that's getting it on the airplane, cinema of the Far East or whatever it is, and same scenario is playing out, and so it's fun to watch that happening throughout the series. I love that.
The more that I think about Dead Reckoning now, I can totally see that. Because even the train scene when he's kind of like coaching her, like where to move.
I will never let anything happen to you. He keeps saying, he says that. And because he realizes, and you'll see, if you go back and watch it, you'll see the exact moment where it shifts, where he's gone from who is this to I know who this is, with that. And it's a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, because he was like very committed to her for seemingly no reason. I'm like, oh, wow.
More so than he was to even Ilsa, and Ilsa knows why.
Okay. All right. I'm on board. Where's Corey with his conspiracy theories? Corey always has conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Again, it pays to rewatch, right? Good stuff. Okay. We talked a lot about world building, and I love that we said, Justin, the thing you said about the two types of movies, I think that's a perfect way to say it, right? That this is a movie that you could either watch carefully or kind of barely pay attention to. Either way, there's a lot more that you can chew on, like we just talked about with Dead Reckoning, that you can pick up on this stuff and kind of speculate or do, or connections from this movie to the, you know, the White Widow later on. So I think we're ready for final thoughts. So David, I'll start with you. Final thoughts on this film and Mission Impossible.
I think that it's because of the kind of the time period that came out and the way that it was initially received. You know, you talked about the critics and the cast, the original cast, and their frustrations with it. I think that it's overlooked as being more than just a fun movie with Tom Cruise hanging in a room being quiet. I think that's the way a lot of people view this movie. But if you go back and you really watch this from the beginning and pay attention, like you were talking about, or, you know, that you can watch this with something else going on, or you can really focus in on it. The story is really pretty good, and it's a lot of fun to watch and worth watching. And again, I think it's worth kind of seeing how that story plays itself out in future installments in the franchise in very subtle ways. I think Tom Cruise has built something that's pretty special in this franchise.
I think it's a pretty underrated franchise. Like, for how many, with the exception of two, all of the movies are solid. Mm. Like, there's not really a low point, with the exception of two. And I feel like it just doesn't get the same love that other franchises get. I mean, obviously, it gets plenty of love. All of them are really big box office successes, but I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I kind of feel like in between releases of this movie, I tend to forget that the franchise exists, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't my final thoughts. I don't want that to be my final thought. I like this movie. So I was just sorry. I was tailing onto that. Final thoughts. Okay. So Mission Impossible 1 is very different in like tone than the rest of the movies. Right. I mean, the rest of the movies use kind of a similar formula of like, okay, we have to have a heist. We have to have, you know, X, Y, Z in these movies, but it still works so incredibly well. And it's just like, it's a movie that you're going to watch over and over. Like, it's classic. It's for the most part, pretty ageless. Like, nothing really dates it too bad. There is some, I think some, we didn't mention this, but some CGI with the helicopter in the train scene, It's not bad. It's still like amazing for the most part.
Still pretty good. Yeah.
Still pretty good. And that's an impressive thing to do because, as I've said on this podcast multiple times, I feel like 1995 ish to like 2005 era, like those 10 years, movies took a hit. Like, I can't think of a lot of good movies that came out during that time. It's like when CGI kind of started hitting, like there was kind of an overuse of it a little bit. But this movie really holds back on a lot of that stuff, still uses a lot of practical effects. It's like a very slow build. It doesn't give in to all like the action hero tropes. And it just launched the rest of the franchise, which is just an awesome thing to do. And the movies have really only, I don't want to say they've gotten better, but they've just all been so solid. And you just don't see that in a lot of franchises. There's usually a trash one in there somewhere, especially when you have
one. There is in this one. It's
the there is in this one, but we're just going to ignore two. They ignore two. I'm going to ignore two. Doesn't work. They made a mistake. It's fine.
Yeah.
Let them live their life.
You can almost skip two in a rewatch, and it makes no impact whatsoever on the story.
No, I just did. I just did a rewatch, and I didn't even bother to watch two. I think I watched, because I always like to watch the trailer before I watch the movie, and I watched the trailer, and I'm like, nope.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
No.
But the hair and the doves.
Right off the bat, Tom Cruise's hair, like just his hair. I can't even. Nah, I'm done.
It's Anything else?
Oh, I do have a question. So, favorite movie in the franchise?
Oh.
That's my question. Question mark.
I'm going to go Fallout.
Fallout. And as we all know, Fallout is six. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, Henry Cavill cocking his fist.
Henry Cavill. Yeah, that was kind of a cool moment, wasn't it? I think it's become Dead Reckoning Part One, or Dead Reckoning. I guess that's what it is now. And I think that partly it has to do with all the things for me and my son Nathan as we went back. We literally saw the movie six times in the first 6 days in order to continue the conversation with Christopher McQuarrie and try to find the Easter egg that he was teasing with us. And so we dug into that movie in ways you cannot even begin to imagine as it first came out. And so I have an appreciation for that film that's pretty special because it holds up really, really well digging into it as much as we did.
Sorry, David. Dead Reckoning is my least favorite. With the exception of two.
Go back and watch it with Ailey Atwell being the daughter, and it'll change everything for you. So
I think it might, because there were a lot of things in my brain that didn't add up. Like why are you so connected to this like rando you just met? So maybe that almost changed my perception.
Why does
Elsa
give her life up?
Yeah,
all of that.
Okay, I'm gonna rewatch. But
is she really dead though?
No,
I don't think so. I'm gonna throw some more shade onto you as well. I think that this movie, the one we just talked about, Mission Impossible 1, is kind of lost in the fact that the second one had such a stink on it that really we go with the movie, the series kind of restarts with 3, and then Bad Robot comes in. And thank goodness for Alias, which I love that show so much because Tom Cruise binge watched the first 2 seasons, which are fantastic. We talked about Alias on the show once.
For every time Craig said I love Alias. Well, like,
I'm telling you, dude, Mission Impossible 3.
Never watched an episode of Alias, is it worth a binge?
Absolutely. Really? The first 2 seasons especially are fantastic, and almost every single one ends on a cliffhanger. Look, Justin's just laughing. You know, it's really, really good. It's great storytelling. And if you're familiar with number 3, which I know you are, you will watch number 3 and go, this feels like an episode of Alias.
It's in the same universe. Is that it's, it?
Well, not quite, because what's his name? Greg Grunberg is in. He plays a major character in Alias. So when he showed it, essentially playing the same character. Like it's so much Alias, you even have that character, kind of. Yeah,
Justin, Benji's character. You know, Craig messaged me before this and told me make sure that I bring up Alias and ask if it's a good series.
Did he really?
No, he didn't.
So. Benji, oh my goodness. Benji is a riff on Marshall. There's a guy that's basically that same character. Like it feels so many ways like an episode of Alias. It really, like, tangibly so. I was like, wow, sitting in the theater going, this feels like Alias. Now the first 2, I love it all, but the first 2 seasons are just peak network television, in my opinion. It's great.
See, I've worked and been friends with Craig and in close proximity for so long that I honestly feel like I could do a pretty halfway decent job of impersonating him if I had one of the Mission Impossible masks. Like, they would not be able to tell the difference. So much so, and Craig, this is embarrassing for you, I'm sorry. I made a bingo sheet for Craig.
That's true.
Like, common phrases that Craig says that I just know. And I swear once a week I just yell bingo because
if you're new to the show, we work together. So
Oh yes. Yeah. Man. So if I have to hear one more stinking thing about Alias,
the tiny little rabbit trail though, it is on Disney Plus. It's readily available, although they've changed the background music. So it doesn't quite hit the same way. Cause it was because of music rights. Like in the pilot episode, there's a song by the Cranberries, which is a great song. And now it's just some generic grocery store song that you'd hear. It's J.J. Abrams, Michael Giacchino does the score. So all of that's great. But oftentimes there's songs that are, and it's kind of random. Like there's a Sinead O'Connor song that plays just fine over the end. So that takes me out of it because I'm looking for those particular songs and then they don't show up. But the action and the acting and all the writing is great. It's really good.
Awesome.
Okay. So that's what I was just saying with all that being said is that it feels in a lot of ways like 3 started the franchise or restarted the franchise. And so we oftentimes forget about this film or there's this disconnect. We have this buffer of number 2, which no one watches, but go back and watch number 1 because it is fantastic. It still holds up. even the technology, you'll kind of watch wistfully and go, yeah, that's kind of dated, but that's fine. Because it's such a good story. The acting is great. And I love what you said, Justin, multiple times, but like, it doesn't fall into those action movie tropes. Like, it's a smart film that finds creative ways to get around things. So I love it. It's a good film. Before we get out of here, David, I want to give you an opportunity to just kind of talk about your podcast and what's been going on with that. I know you guys are in a little bit of a hiatus, but there's a huge back catalog, some great stuff. I thoroughly enjoyed the Kingdom Come stuff that you guys did, that series. Cool. But if you want to talk about that for just a minute.
Yeah. So, 6+ years ago, at the time, 16 and 12 year old sons and I put a microphone up on our kitchen table in California, recorded the first episode of Tatooine Sons, a Star Wars podcast, and have had a ton of fun with that. Got the opportunity to name a character in the Last Jedi about 2 months after the movie came out. Fun video and fun episodes about that. We believe that pop culture is the mythology of this generation. And there's a story that's written on our souls, and that these myths speak to that story. And that's why we talk about all of our favorite franchises and dig into it. And it's fun if you're going to go back and you want to hear two kids grow up talking about movies and pop culture and learn about life as they're doing it. It's a lot of fun to do that. We are on a hiatus because my oldest son is 22 years old, finishing up his engineering degree. And graduating on May the 4th, which is ironic, for a Star Wars nerd like him. And, my youngest son is 18, graduating from high school and getting ready to go into his production technology degree, next year. And so we're pausing to let them finish all that stuff up. But the plan, which is actually getting laid out in detail next week, we will be picking back up probably in June. With regular episodes then. So get caught up and get ready, because it's going to be a lot of fun.
Awesome. And I'm not ashamed to say that I was inspired by what you did with your kids, where I brought my kids on a couple of times.
Our kids, Craig.
Well, my kids. Well, Corey's had his kids on. He had Jude on
for our Transformers episode. Like, we had shared kids. I was just checking out.
Well, collectively we do. And then my daughter was on for Lego Batman. And
love it.
And Into the Spider-Verse, so. And those were very just cool. Amazing to get to share those opportunities with your kids.
It has changed our relationship in such a really cool way with it. So love it.
That's awesome.
Would never have traded any of those episodes for anything else. So.
So as we close, we just want to say thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to connect with us, you can find us on X and Facebook, email us at readingbetweenreels@gmail.com, or use the SpeakPipe app on our website. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend. Support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast catcher. Our next episode will be a review of Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes, starring Robert Downey Jr. Send us an email or voicemail about your favorite moments from Sherlock Holmes, and we'll share it on the next episode.